Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Katrina Gishard and Chris Sullivan at the traffic desk. We'll get to traffic in a moment. First, we want to welcome in Margaret Brennan, moderator of Face the Nation on CBS News. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning.
There is a national drug shortage happening right now. I'm aware of a couple. Adderall is a big one. Ozempic, because it's being used for weight loss and it's for diabetes as well. And cancer drugs, too. So this is going to be a big topic of discussion on your show this Sunday.
That's right. Well, welcome back to the program, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, to talk to him about why some of these shortages are so acute. It's actually risen to the level now where the White House and Congress are looking at what's happening in the drug market. There is a team looking for, trying to ways to fix the supply chain here, because the U.S. is still heavily reliant on at least ingredients that come from Asia. And as you mentioned, there are very serious shortages, in particular with cancer drugs. So we want to talk to him about ways to solve this and what's driving it.
Yeah, very important indeed. Also, as the debt limit talks continue, the president is being criticized for headed to Japan for the G7 summit. Even criticism from Chicago's Fed president saying, hey, this is not the way to mess with the nation's economy, especially not right now. So as far as the debt limit talks go, where are they in that? And is the criticism of President Biden warranted?
Well, we know that overnight, President Biden left a dinner in Japan with the leaders of the world's largest democratic economies, the G7, to go get a briefing remotely from his staff back in Washington, who are negotiating with House Republicans on a deal that would do two things. One, it would address future spending, like a budget, and it would lift the debt ceiling, so agree to pay America's past bills before that June 1st deadline. That's the date the Treasury Secretary says the United States would default on its obligations for the first time in history. And that would have huge implications for the global economy. It is U.S. debt, U.S. treasuries that are the bedrock of the financial system, and you're already seeing borrowing costs increase. The nation's biggest banks met with the Treasury Secretary this week to talk about that there are already reverberations ahead of that deadline. So it is embarrassing, no doubt, for the president to stand before the largest economies and say it is America that is threatening the global financial system because of its own dysfunction in coming to an agreement politically between the two parties on how to pay its past obligations. Both sides have blinked. The White House blinked by agreeing to talk about future spending in a negotiation with Republicans, and Republicans have said that they are, willing to talk about a number of different things with the White House that perhaps in the past they had said they wouldn't consider. So we don't know the contours yet of a deal. We know President Biden has publicly said he would consider doing things like adding to or tightening work requirements on certain government aid programs, something Republicans have pushed. That's not something liberal progressives are welcoming at this point. So the president may have some issues in his own party. On the Republican side, Senator Kevin McCarthy, it is well known, has a number of people within the Republican caucus who are just flat out refusing to lift the debt ceiling without dramatic cuts.
Wow. And what, President Biden, back when he was vice president, and of course, in his decades in Congress, he is known as a top negotiator. I'm not as familiar with McCarthy's style of negotiations, but it's surprising to me that President Biden seems to be playing it cool as we near this date.
Well, it is interesting that President Biden, he likes to talk about himself as a deal maker and often does try to be hands-on. He has left this with his staff at the moment, though he says he's fully engaged. In the past, when the United States in 2011 almost came to the point of default, it was Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, at the time, who brokered an agreement because House Republicans couldn't come to one with the White House. So it was that sort of back channel that helped it happen. This time, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell has said, no, you have to talk to the House, that it is Speaker McCarthy who has a really difficult politics here, and it has to be a direct talk with him. So that was part of this, choreography that happened to get us to this point where Mitch McConnell was like, you're not going to come to me to solve this problem. You have to talk directly to McCarthy so that he can get the vote ultimately to make it happen. So, yes, there's plenty of criticism here that these negotiations didn't start earlier. But the bottom line is the politics are much more complicated now than they were back in 2011. We don't know what the votes will look like. We'll talk about this on Sunday with two men who call themselves problem solvers, Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey and Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania.
I was going to say the 2011 Republican Party is not the 2023 Republican Party, and I'm guessing a lot of it has to do with that. I'm also guessing that tighter work requirements for WIC and SNAP benefits doesn't move the needle for the entire U.S. economy. So why is the Republican Party hung up on this particular issue?
I don't know that they're hung up on that one issue. That's just the one that has become public, right? It's one that House progressives in particular have made clear they don't like what the president said he'd be considering. So oftentimes when things become public, it's because someone wants to kill them. But we will see. I don't know. We do know that in the House Republican bill that passed already on party lines a week or two ago, that there were work requirements in that Republicans had put in there. That's just to try to find areas of savings. I mean, look, none of this is going to, solve all of America's financial issues here in terms of dealing with the deficit. Also, what the parties are talking about is, zeroing out unspent COVID funding, so funding that was already allocated but not spent, and talking about that as if it were a saving. That's not necessarily new money. It's just not spending money you already said you were going to spend. So there are other things that are being discussed at this point, but the work requirements are something that are politically very difficult.
Got it. Well, if you enjoyed this conversation, Margaret Brennan has much more for you coming up this Sunday on CBS. She's the moderator of Face the Nation. Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And at 6:37, we welcome Felix Bunnell, our resident historian, to the studio for All Over the Map, a quick look at stories behind local places and things. Now, I had forgotten about this, but now I'm remembering your investigation into the old Parkland School in Pierce County. It was threatened with demolition last year. Community members came to action. They said, no, you can't do this. They managed to convince the owner of it that they can buy it, but they still have a lot of money to raise. Just how much?
Yeah, well, they're celebrating the 115th birthday of that school this weekend, and we'll get to the dollar amount in a moment because it's kind of a medium-sized amount. So last year we learned that PLU, Pacific Lutheran University, which is down in Parkland, east of Tacoma, they had plans to demolish that 1908 Parkland school. They'd owned it for years. They wanted to get a demolition permit and sell it to a developer to put up a bunch of apartments. That's not a bad thing, right? That's when a group of Parkland residents got involved. They loved the old school. Many of them went there. Their parents and grandparents went there. Some even taught there years ago.
Wow.
They organized. They showed up at big public meetings. And ultimately, they got the Pierce County Landmarks and Historic Preservation Commission to deny PLU's request for a demolition permit. So why do people in Parkland care so much about this old school? Phil Edlund is with the Parkland Community Association's Save Parkland School Project. I'd say his answer to that question is like that old real estate cliche, location, location, location. But with one more element, community, community, community.
It sits right in the heart of the community, right near the Main Street area of the business district, and is the identifying landmark when people get off of Highway 512 onto Pacific Avenue, State Route 7. When they see the building, they always express a sense of, I know I've arrived in Parkland when I see Parkland School.
Yeah, Parkland's, I get that.
It's the Space Needle of Parkland.
Yeah,
I just made that up, and they're welcome to use that if they want.
Yes. Edmonds has similar buildings where if they weren't there, it wouldn't be Edmonds.
You see it, you don't even think about it, you just know. Now, to the Parkland group's credit and to PLU's as well, they got past that ugly demolition battle, right? And they made a truce. PLU agreed to split off the school building for the larger parcel of land. They'll still sell most of the land to a real estate developer for apartments, but they'll sell the school to the Parkland Community Association for about $3 million. Now, Phil Edlund says this isn't just about nostalgia. The ultimate goal is to create something Parkland desperately needs, a place for the community to gather.
Whether it's children in after school activities, whether it's sports or homework tutoring, or for adults or for arts activities on the stage, this is intended to be a place that serves people who live and work in and around Parkland.
So it's a perfect solution. Parkland needs something like this. There's nothing like that in
Going
Parkland.
Going back to Edmonds, the Francis Anderson Center.
Oh, I love
used
that place.
To be a school.
Exactly.
Now it's the Parks and Rec. It's the library. It's the community
Absolutely.
Center.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's
Absolutely.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, so the event tomorrow is at Keithley Middle School, which is nearby. It's from noon to 3. There's two things on the agenda. They'll celebrate that 115th birthday with food and games and other activities. And they'll kick off the community phase of the fundraising campaign to buy Parkland School from PLU. They'll also get people's ideas about what they want to see happen with the old school. Now, on that fundraising part, they have a little more than 5 months to raise $2.85 million. Okay. Deadline's November 3rd. They'll likely get some public dollars from the state of Washington, but that's some serious cash. I think they can do it, though. I mean, this group, the way they organized and came together is amazing. The best place to get more information, or if you want to contribute, is saveparklandschool.org. I love community projects like this.
Yes.
Because instead of people sitting around and complaining about things not being a certain way, they got in, they rolled up their sleeves and organized with their neighbors and friends, and now they're well on their way. But, I mean, that's a lot of money they still have to raise. But all the signs look really good to me. So congratulations to getting this far, and good luck in the next long haul over the next 5 months or so.
And they have you behind them. And if I know anything about Felix Bernal, is if it's to save an old
He's
building,
deranged. Yes,
you
yes,
will
yes.
throw yourself in front of those bulldozers for them. So
I haven't had the opportunity to do that yet, but I hope I get to do that. Before I wrap this whole thing up, it would be nice to chain myself to a bulldozer someday. So thanks for noticing, Colleen.
Of course. And good luck to Parkland community organizers. Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, in for Dave Ross, who has the day off today. Katrina Guichard is with us, and Chris Sullivan as well. Automakers want to break up with AM radio waves. This has been going on for a long time, this conversation, and they're getting serious. So Congress is saying, not so fast. CBS's Jim Krasulas is with us this morning. Jim, Congress says it's a safety issue.
That's right, Colleen. You know, in this age of pretty much no bipartisanship in Washington, I think it's interesting that there's this bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers. They have introduced legislation to prevent automakers from eliminating AM broadcast radio in new vehicles. About 8 brands have already done that. I had a chat yesterday, Colleen, to talk to Curtis Leggett. He's president of the National Association of Broadcasters. And yes, he talked about the role that AM radio plays in terms of getting emergency information out to folks. That's long been associated, obviously, with AM radio, and that's why the NAB is considering this a security issue. Now, that being said, lobbyists for these automakers, Colleen, say that this nationwide alert system that is basically handled by FEMA can distribute this emergency information over many other devices now other than AM radio and cars. Internet-based radio, satellite radio, cellular networks, FM radio, all of that.
Yes, but as we know, working in radio, if the electrical grid fails, if you don't have power for your phone, if satellites go down, you still have your crank radio for emergency issues, and that's how you get the FEMA broadcast. That's true for our sister station, 710 Seattle Sports. They're the FEMA-designated station that will take over
Sure.
in a natural disaster. So, you know, what is the response to people just use their phones today?
Well, that's a good point. And again, I think back over the many years I've done news coverage and all of the hurricanes and mm-hmm. the natural disasters I've covered in the aftermath, and the fact that in a lot of cases, AM radio has been the lifeblood of information for people. The CBS radio station in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, when I was down there for 5 weeks, I remember they did an incredible job of community service, of keeping people informed and giving people information. I remember that being done, Colleen, in 1989 with Hurricane Hugo, mm-hmm. when that monster storm hit South Carolina. Same thing with the local AM radio stations. In fact, in that case, in Charleston's case, I remember several of the television stations, they lost their broadcast antennas
right.
and were off the air. So again, yes, this AM radio has for decades decades has been there for people. And again, so much debate on this issue. It's quite interesting. Curtis Legette also told me yesterday that a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, have contacted members of Congress to say, hey, we have to keep AM radio in cars. We rely on it.
That's right. We're talking with CBS's Jim Krasula about the struggle between Congress and automakers who want to remove AM radio signals from cars. Tesla, BMW, Ford, Volkswagen, some of the automakers who already have. Has there been any fallout from the removal of those AM waves?
Not yet. But again, well, why do automakers want to do this? One point Legette told me yesterday is cost. At least that's part of their argument here. And the fact that they also claim that there's interaction, or at least interference is a better word, with the AM signal in a lot of these electric vehicles.
Oh, interference. So it would actually get in the way of the vehicle operating?
That's right. And in fact, in both ways, the electric vehicle will interfere with the AM radio signal, and the AM radio bandwidth, if you will, could interfere with the electronics in these electric vehicles.
Oh, that's the first I've heard of that. Very interesting. Well, maybe every Tesla should come with, you know, like you have the jack for changing the tire. It can come with under the trunk crank AM radio, just in case of emergency. That might be a little
good
retro.
Idea, perhaps.
Right. So
yes.
What is the next step with this? I don't see Congress losing this battle.
No, in fact, as I said at the outset, it's interesting to me, and I'm sure many others, that this is a bipartisan effort when you consider how little there is of that in Washington these days. So certainly there's interest on both sides of the issue to do this. You know, if I had to bet on this, I would think that Congress would go ahead and say, yeah, you got to keep AM radio. But again, a lot of these vehicles, especially certainly the electric ones, the high dollar ones have already eliminated AM radio.
Perhaps there needs to be a disclaimer signed for electric vehicle owners. Well, CBS's Jim Krasula, always appreciate your conversations. Thanks so much. We'll check in as this bill progresses.
Thanks, Colleen. Always good to talk. Be with you.
It's 7:15 on Seattle's Morning News. If you're just waking up on this gorgeous Friday morning, right now it's 57 degrees on our way to 75. In Montana, Governor Greg Gianforte signed a bill banning TikTok in the state. CBS's Thane Rosenbaum has been following this story. Good morning, Thane.
Good morning, Colleen.
Now, my big question is, why did Montana take action this way? My speculation is because they got spooked by the Chinese spy balloon that was first spotted over Montana.
That, Colleen, and although they implicitly they're making an argument, which a number of red states are making, which is that we just don't think social media is good for our kids. And if we can find a really good legitimate reason to ban them, then it also has the ancillary effect of protecting minors and teenagers. So that I think both of those things are at play. But remember, the federal government has already placed a ban on TikTok for government issued phones. So if you work for the federal government, you couldn't use TikTok on your phone anyway. And half the states have done something similar for the reasons that you said, national security and cybersecurity, on the allegation that the Chinese are actually harvesting personal data from TikTok.
Why can't they come out and say that instead of this app is bad for our kids? Because that argument has been made about violent video games, about Facebook and Twitter, and yet those apps and those games continue to be free.
Yeah, Colleen, and actually the Supreme Court yesterday, little known, not many people are picked up on it. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled in two cases dealing with terrorism, where families of victims of terrorism sued Twitter, Google, Facebook, all the social media companies on the theory that ISIS and Al-Qaeda couldn't operate without you. You can't learn how to make a bomb unless you watch YouTube. And so the families of victims essentially brought cases under the anti-terrorism law. And the Supreme Court in one of the cases ruled 9-0. You never see that.
Yeah.
Right? We always hear now about 9-0 in favor of Twitter. So they essentially they ruled in favor of Twitter over the victims of terrorism. So you have this sort of conflict, right? On the one hand, you know, you have these perceived dangers from social media, but you also have a country that has a very strong tradition of First Amendment freedom, freedom of expression. You might say, I would say, my last book was on free speech, that the founding fathers didn't have TikTok in mind, right? They were not thinking of Grindr and TikTok, right? They were thinking of things like the soapboxes in the Village Green, where you get up on a soapbox and you make a speech. Colleen decides that she doesn't like what the government is doing. That's what they were thinking. So, you know, there is an argument to be made that is TikTok really contributing to the marketplace of ideas? And if it's not, then why can't the government regulate it if it sees that there are dangers involved in using it?
And I've heard from so many of the legal experts on CBS News saying that this is likely not to stand. And a lawsuit has already been filed about this ban on TikTok. What is the argument for that lawsuit, the freedom of speech argument as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, think about the First Amendment right up front, right? The government shall not. That's the first sentence, right? Tells you it's not about freedom of speech as it thinks that the government can't take away your freedom of speech, right? Yeah. So it's very specific. It cannot restrict freedom of speech. And so the issue there goes back to what I said before. There might be an argument to say, but what did the founding fathers mean by freedom of speech? People who use TikTok say it's a manner of my expression. It's how I express myself. Who are you to judge the way I express myself? And this is a platform that, if it's available, then I want to be able to use it. Mm-hmm. And it's one, if the marketplace, the commercial marketplace knocks TikTok out, that's something else. But the government can't stop me from doing it. In this case, Montana's government is stopping you, and that's why the First Amendment is being implicated.
Is there any hard evidence that the owner of TikTok, which is a Chinese company, is sharing this data with the government? They claim they are not, yet our federal government still banned it on government devices. What evidence did they produce to do that?
They didn't really, Colleen, because, you know, again, the government's position is always, I'm not going to tell you because it's got national security implications. I'm not going to tell Colleen. Mm. She's going to tell all of her listeners. So I don't know. If we've actually come up with the concrete hard evidence of it. The government's saying to the American people, trust us. We are in the cybersecurity business. We're in the national security business. We have people monitoring this all the time, and we know that they've been harvesting, that TikTok has been sharing with their parent, in this case, the government of China, information about the United States. Again, you could argue, well, it's one thing for them to share information about the government of the United States, but who cares if the Chinese government has access to what, you know, silly videos are put on TikTok from individuals living, you know, somewhere else. But look, you know, that's the first time that's happened. It's one thing to say that social media companies are generally irresponsible when it comes to kids. It's another thing to say that a foreign government controls it, and that's what this is about.
That, at least, you can galvanize the American public around that. Yeah, give us some evidence that there's some spying going on. The balloon was a great example of how the American public still responds to a foreign government coming in and interfering with our country. So the argument about kids, just, I don't know, I don't buy it, especially not from Montana's Governor Greg Gianforte. And it doesn't appear he's up for election either. So not really grandstanding going on right now.
You know, but it's a red state, you know, and the anti-social media, you know, impulses are strong in the country. That's why I think it's important to think about the case, the 9-0 case. Remember, the conservatives now are 6-3 on the Supreme Court. And when this case came up for our argument months ago, Colleen, I was on radio constantly saying, you know, the Silicon Valley is really worried because they're convinced that these six conservative justices think that, you know, what's on social media is just garbage. You know, they're going to say it's just bad for kids. It's bad. It's bad for everybody. But 9-0, they lined up in favor of the social media companies. Yesterday, there was, you know, sounds of champagne bottles opening all over Silicon Valley because they couldn't believe it. So, you know, I think they agree with you saying that in the end, this stuff is really about, in conservative states, it's about something else, but it can't violate the First Amendment. And that's what it might currently has happened in Montana.
CBS's Thane Rosenbaum, we appreciate your insight on this. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Colleen. Bye-bye.
Your daily dose of kindness now brought to you by Robert W. Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. A fearless Texas teen turned her love of Taylor Swift's music into inspiration as she battled a rare blood disorder and cancer that earned her a reputation to never give up. CBS's Nora O'Donnell has her story.
Halle Barnard is fearless. The 14-year-old was born with a rare blood disease, giving new meaning to superstar Taylor Swift's song, Bad Blood.
I felt like it really applied to me because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm like Taylor Swift. You know, I got bad blood.
The only cure for Halle's condition was a bone marrow transplant. She was desperate for one. That's when she became the mastermind behind Halle's Heroes, a foundation to help others begin again.
It started selfishly as just trying to save my life, but then we realized that there's so many other children out there who needed a bone marrow transplant.
After a 9-year wait, Halle found a match, but she wasn't out of the woods yet. Her condition led to bone cancer and a leg amputation. The music of Taylor Swift got her through the hardest of times.
Sometimes I'd listen to her music and I'd daydream about her and like meeting her and seeing her.
And guess what? Her wildest dreams came true.
I was wondering if you wanted to come with me next Sunday to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour in the front row.
Yes, I would love that.
Halle was ready for it, celebrating a clean bill of health in style at the Houston stop on the Eras Tour.
It was just such a beautiful moment.
How about that? A total fairy tale. And we can tell you that Halle's Heroes has helped find more than 300 bone marrow matches. And Halle tells us she wants to be a doctor when she grows up.
That is Nora O'Donnell with the story. 7:48. It's time to welcome G. Scott from the G and Ursula Show on Seattle's Morning News. Do you like dad jokes, G? He's getting his headphones plugged in. We're a little bit in disarray this morning.
I love dad jokes.
Do you? Okay.
I do.
Our listeners have been sharing dad jokes with us this morning.
All right, let me hear them.
And let's see, one of our favorites. Do you know the difference between an elephant and a loaf of bread?
I don't.
If you answer no, I'm not sending you to the store for a loaf of bread. What's the difference between an alligator and a crocodile?
Something about see you later.
Oh, yes, an alligator will see you later, a crocodile after a while. Do you have any dad jokes?
Not off the top of my head right now, no. But I think that the older that men get, it is a natural thing. It's not even a joke. It's actually like that's how we talk. It's what we say.
You just want to bother people.
Yes. What would be okay? So,
what do tapeworms and the Eiffel Tower have in common?
What?
They're both parasites.
Oh. So this I met this guy the other day. His name was Dr. Sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was Dr. Sugar.
Is that his real name? Or?
No, it's his real name.
Okay.
Yeah, for real.
And, is he a dentist?
No. So he comes in and he was done with the procedure. And I said, sweet.
How many times has he heard that? Or was that the first time?
He just looked at me. And I just wanted to tell him so bad, I'm really just not normal.
No, you just
but I had to. Yeah. I said, Dr. Sugar, sweet.
I like that. Well, we're supposed to be talking about something completely different than dad jokes, but I just wanted to put a smile on your face this morning.
It worked.
And I know how much you guys love your G and Ursula listeners. I know we have a lot of crossover, but this is when the text line is at its best.
Okay,
when
come
we
on.
Can share in a laugh and have some fun.
Oh, no,
so thank
no,
you guys. 888-973-5476. So Seattle is the worst city in the United States for...
What are we terrible about now? What we do now?
Not cleaning up or doggy dookie.
Oh, a lot of y'all not cleaning up your poop.
Yeah.
You know, I was surprised by that. I would have thought that that we would be the best here, right?
Because we have such a high per capita.
Because every time I see people doing the right thing. Like most of the time I see little Lois, little Gretchen walking around with the little bags and, and so they're walking around and it's around their wrist and you guys are walking around with the poop bag. And I love that that happens. I was shocked. I'm surprised if cities like Chicago, where I'm from, is not one of the worst. Because I'm telling you right now.
Maybe they don't have as many dogs.
They must don't. I know they ain't got no bags.
Yeah.
I'm not used to seeing folks with bags.
What are you talking about? Chicago doesn't have bags?
Nah, just leave it right there. It's good for the grass.
We have a serial pooper in my Edmonds community. Whenever I go to pick up my daughter at school, I'd say 7 times out of 10, there's a fresh one right there. To the point where the neighbors who own that property on the other side of the fence have put up a little sign with a roll of baggies that says, please click. They are even providing the poop bags, and somebody still leaves it there.
So I thought Seattle was just, so it's being said, I was according to the article, if I remember right, that Tucson, Arizona, are the best.
I believe that.
When it comes to dogs.
Because I believe Arizona has a higher, older population, and I think that there's more respect there. There's more expectation. Also, a lot more, do you ever notice that like boomers are always afraid of other people watching them and judging what they're doing, and so they behave in a certain way so that people like them and that they don't get attention put on them. So I think that's what it is. It's the societal shame and pressure to pick up your dog's poop.
Which on one hand, we can make fun of that, but on another, I think that that actually makes the world better when people are concerned with people watching them like, oh, I need to do the right thing.
That's healthy pressure. Healthy shame.
Healthy pressure.
Yeah, if there is
now,
healthy shame.
Now, the young Knicks of the world, these Gen Z folks, they don't care.
No.
They don't care anything. They have no respect for these adults and generations and authority.
You're sounding old now. I'll tell you this much, though. Love cats and dogs. I do not get the argument of choosing cats over dogs or dogs over cats.
I do.
They're both awesome.
No, they're not.
But whenever I see somebody picking up a fresh, warm, steaming pile of poop off the sidewalk, it confirms why I've had cats most of my life.
I didn't know you was a cat lover like me.
Yeah, I'm a cat. We talked about this. When I found out you had cats, I was like, you're my people.
I got cats.
Yeah.
Cats make, they're clean. Yeah. They mind their business. Yeah.
You can leave them for a couple days with a bowl of food. They're fine.
No doubt about it. Yeah. You ever got that friend that's like, oh, I got to get going. I got to get home to Oscar.
Got to let him out.
Got to let him out.
Got to pay somebody $50 an hour to let him out.
Right. Yeah. Or I got to give the neighborhood kid, the neighborhood kids don't come over there for $10 no more.
Right.
You're paying $100 while you're gone out of town to get all that done.
So Seattle, pick up your poop. All right. Bottom line, right? Is that what it is?
Especially when it's steaming.
Yeah, though it's true, though. You think about feeling that, ugh, I don't like it. Cats clean up after themselves. 7:53, Sully's a cat guy, too. You've got, what, Chico and I always
Chico and Sammy.
Sammy, that's right. Yeah,
Chico.
Who's your big boy?
Chico. He's Chico's 26 pounds.
Yeah, he's the chalky boy.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He spends a lot of time at the gym. He never skips leg day.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.